coming up.
Most people are really lousy liars. Only about 4 or 5% of the people, and we've studied quite a number of people, are very good at it.
Faces, feelings, and lies.
Politeness, flattery, embellishment. You can't play poker without deceiving.
Do our micro-expressions betray our lies?
The emotions are performed on the stage of identity. You do very well in telling when people are concealing how they feel. But what if they're lying about what they did?
Can a good liar fool a good lie detector?
Oh, a lie detector doesn't detect lies, it detects emotion.
Our guest is world-renowned psychologist Paul Ekman.
People sometimes ask me, why do you train police? I'd like less mistakes.
Recorded in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Faces, feelings, and lies.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
And that's no lie.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're recording the program in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome everyone to Philosophy Talk. Our topic today, faces, feelings, and lies.
Well, Ken, I know what a face is, and I'm pretty sure what a lie is, but I'm not so sure about feelings. I mean, is it really feelings that are the issue or emotions?
John, I think you must be, like, in the grip of some philosophical puzzle that you learned from the old philosophy. Look, we're going to talk about how people can read emotions from the face. We all know what an emotion is. It's a feeling. I mean, think of anger. Anger is an emotion, but it's also a feeling. Pride is an emotion, and it's also a feeling. I mean, well, what's bugging you about that?
Well, I don't think it's quite that simple. I mean, when I say feeling, I mean the inner experience we have in various situations, including when we have emotions. But there's more to an emotion than the inner feeling. Usually they have a cognitive element.
You mean like if you're angry, you're angry about something. I mean, if you carelessly spill coffee on me again, I would have a feeling of anger. But it would be anger at you for spilling the coffee or being careless or something like that. The emotion is this complex thing. It involves both the feeling and this belief that it gives rise to and sustains that feeling.
Well, I mean, that's the way many philosophers look at it, and it seems right to me. Sometimes we do feel anger, but we don't know what we're angry about. That's not all that uncommon, but it strikes us as a little bit odd. We say, well, I mean, angry, but it's odd. I don't know what I'm angry about.
Yeah. Your favorite philosopher, David Hume, thought that the very same inner feeling, this feeling, could be connected with different emotions. So that makes emotions really complex.
Now Hume had an interesting theory. Let's take you, for example. Pretty soon you're going to finish this book you've been working on since I've known you on Norms.
Right, someday.
Let's assume, which is true, I'm sure, that it will be an excellent book. You will feel proud of it. That's an emotion. You'll feel proud of it. Now, Hume would say, well, you got to distinguish between the cause of the pride, that's the excellence of the book, the object of the pride, that's you, because you wrote it, and the feeling is pleasure. But now, compare that to another emotion, the esteem you feel for me.
Yeah.
Now, the cause of that emotion is my intelligence and wit, right? So I'm the cause, my intelligence and wit, and I'm the object. But the feeling is basically the same, pleasure, same feeling. Yeah. Pride when it's about you, esteem when it's for me.
John, I think maybe you don't have that quite right, but think about the anger I had for you when you carelessly spilled coffee on me. What about that?
Well, I mean, Hume, that was one of Hume's favorite examples. So in the anger case, the cause is my spilling coffee. The object is me. That's who you're angry at. And the feeling is displeasure. If you spilled coffee on yourself, and I'm sure that happens too, that would be the cause. The object would be you and not me, and the feeling would be displeasure, same feeling, but the emotion would be humiliation, not anger.
Yeah, there you go. Now, look, I get your point. I don't suppose Hume has the last word on emotions. I mean, there's lots
not
after
today.
Hume. But look, but I like this framework. It's a useful framework. We got cause, object, and feeling. That seems like a useful framework. And maybe that framework explains why it can be so hard to tell what emotion another person is having. I mean, you have to know what they're feeling. You know, whether it's pleasure or displeasure, who it's directed at, the object, then you have to know the cause. So, of course, it's going to be very hard to interpret emotions.
That's where faces come in our title. We are, in fact, very good at detecting other people's emotions. I mean, we as a species, not meaning all of us or most of us most of the time, but some of us that put our minds to it can do it very well. Matter of fact, you may be better at detecting other people's emotions than your own. And it has to do with faces. Faces are the mirror of the soul, as Wittgenstein said. And today, our guest is the world's foremost authority on faces and emotions, San Francisco's very own Paul Ekman.
You know, this is really fascinating stuff, because emotions are, as we say, complex. But we do this thing, and which raises the question, if what you're saying is right, why do we have all this elaborate equipment, say, like lie detectors, if we could just look at faces and tell what's going on? I mean, and come to think of it, rather than have me strip or x-ray me, why can't the security people at airports just ask me, are you planning to blow up this plane?
Well, if we could put Paul Ekman at every airport and talk to every passenger, that might work. But I don't know to what extent that's exportable, but that's a question we're going to put to our guest. And we'll want our live audience here at the Marsh to join in the conversations with questions and comments, too.
We'll soon learn how psychologists can interpret facial expressions and detect lies. But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Andy McDaniel, introduces us to someone who studies how artists look at faces. She files this report.
So first, I want to give you some stuff just to loosen you up a little bit, just physically. So
Kay Kostopoulos is leading a group of Stanford psychology students through a series of exercises.
This is not only to warm you up, but it's also to get your breath into your body.
First, they jump up and down. Then they loosen their neck muscles by rolling their heads from side to side.
You feel that breath coming into your body?
But Kostopoulos isn't a yoga teacher, or a psychology teacher, for that matter. She's an actor.
Actors are different than other people because we pay more attention to things, or we're supposed to pay more attention to things than other people do.
Kostopoulos was hired by David Wilkins, a faculty member at Stanford who teaches a class on facial emotions.
If we think about trying to understand what goes on in the face, for centuries and centuries, artists have been preeminent. You know, the types of portraits we've seen, acting on the stage, they just are extremely good at conveying emotional state.
Wilkins isn't interested in understanding the face so he can tell whether someone is lying. What he wants to do is figure out who knows the face best, psychologists or artists and actors.
Artists are very individualistic type people, and the fact that they would all be using the same technique for so many centuries suggests there might be something really important there. It's really trying to understand the power of the training methods they use to see what goes on in the face.
One of the first things Kay Kostopoulos teaches students about facial expressions is that you can't fake it.
There's a difference between striking your muscles to produce an emotion or having an emotional memory that makes the face move in a certain way.
Kostopoulos is referring to method acting, the technique actors use of conjuring up an intense memory to inspire their face and body to convey a particular emotion. She had to use this approach when modeling for another part of Wilkins' class, in which he has an artist teach students how to draw faces using Kostopoulos as a model.
I actually used some of my actor technique going back to a real emotion, a real event that happened to me. And once I brought that up, my face just went into those positions. I didn't have to think about, oh no, I have to raise my eyebrow or, you know, I have to pout.
Clearly, the fields of psychology, art, and acting have a lot to teach each other. But in the meantime, Kay Kostopoulos believes that good actors will always be experts in some areas.
The eyes and what the eyes reveal, where the focus is, whether you're looking into someone's eyes or you look away, or you blink or you look down or you look up, where do the eyes go?
So if you're trying to get away with something, you should probably just wear sunglasses. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Andy McDaniel.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor. And you're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
And we're joined now by Paul Ekman. He's a world-renowned expert on facial expressions and the emotion. So he's a scientific consultant for the Fox television series Lie to Me. He's a prolific author. He's been, I think, rated by Time as one of the most 100 influential people of the 20th century. And he's pertinent to our current topic. Well, lots of his work is pertinent to our current topic, but in particular, Telling Lies, Clues to Deceit in the Marketplace, Politics, and Marriage. Paul, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much.
Paul Ekman, your life to another academic reads like a fantasy. You've been involved for years and years and years in really serious research, which usually leaves people in obscurity. But you're not obscure at all. You're on Time magazine's list. You're on everybody's list of the great psychologists. And now you've even got a TV show very loosely based on you. I know you're not from England and you don't tell lies, you just detect lies. But so there's so much about your life I could ask you about, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to ask you one little question. Briefly, what led to your interest in lying and emotions?
Serendipity, which is what's led me almost every path I've taken. I was asked, 1967, by a group of young psychiatrists, how can I tell whether a patient admitted because of a serious suicidal intent is lying or telling the truth when they say, doctor, let me spend the weekend with my family. I'm no longer depressed, because we know that some of them within an hour take their life. And it took me about 25 years to get some answers. But it wasn't my question. I don't know if they ever would have thought of it if they hadn't asked me.
Now, one of your discoveries, and maybe a key discovery, is that of a micro expression.
I'm actually a co-discoverer.
Okay.
Ernst Haggard discovered them roughly at the same time, but he thought they represented just repressed emotion. Mm-hmm. And what I was able to show that they also occur when we deliberately conceal our emotions. But all they tell you is an emotion is being concealed. They don't tell you why. They don't tell you what triggered that emotion. All they tell you is the person is trying to hide it from you. And what we know is that most people won't see them. And yet, you can learn to see them in about an hour. It's amazing. Why, if you can learn it so quickly, why don't we already know it?
So how micro is micro?
25th of a second.
25th of a second, okay. Yeah, if you were to train me to spot liars by their micro expressions, and if I was a fairly apt pupil, could I do as well or better than a lie detector?
Oh, a lie detector doesn't detect lies, it detects emotion. Microexpressions are only one of the tools we teach national security or law enforcement or medical students. You have to look at all of demeanor. Now, microexpressions, you do very well in telling when people are concealing, when they're lying about how they feel. But what if they're lying about what they did? Microexpressions are not going to tell you what they did, only perhaps what they feel about what they did or about your asking a question about it. So it's important, but you have to be very careful unless you're in psychotherapy where you just want the emotion and want to know what that is.
This is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. We're discussing faces, feelings, and lies with world-renowned psychologist Paul Ekman.
In our next segment, we're going to look more closely at the anatomy of a lie.
Sex, lives, and audio tape, or at any rate, lies and live radio, along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Smiling faces tell lies, and I got proof. Oh, Lord, yeah.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. It's true, as the song says, that smiling faces sometimes tell lies. And our topic today is faces, feelings, and lies. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and with us is Paul Ekman, consultant for the Fox television series Lie to Me, and author of Telling Lies, Clues to Deceit in the Marketplace, Politics, and Marriage.
Soon our live audience here at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco will join in. How are you as a lie detector, or as a liar, for that matter? Can you get away with lies? Can others fool you? Join the discussion by stepping up to one of the two microphones.
So, Paul, you, before the break, you were saying, you kind of led into our next question. I mean, lying is a simple word, but it's a complicated phenomenon, as you yourself were just saying. I mean, people lie in different ways, for different reasons, about different kinds of things. They lie about what they saw, what they're feeling. You know, when it comes to lie detection, I mean, help us walk through that. I'm sure not all lies are the same. Or do you have a system of classification of lies, maybe, that helps you figure out what's going on? I mean,
well, I distinguish lies from other kinds of deception.
Okay.
So politeness, flattery, embellishment, bargaining. You can't play poker without deceiving, but everybody knows you're going to deceive. That's not a lie. From my point of view, a lie is a deliberate attempt to mislead without notification. So you don't know. Am I going to tell you? I mean, if I'm in court, I'm supposed to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth. Will I or won't I? You don't know. That's where serious lies
are. So that's a nice distinction, I take your point. But when I'm in a, does the face behave differently when, say, I'm playing poker, you know, and when I'm just telling a flat-out lie when there's not no, I mean, how the...
One of our critical findings is if the stakes are very high, particularly the threat of punishment, then it doesn't matter what you're lying about, whether you're lying about whether you're cheating on your wife or your employer, we're going to see the same things. But once again, it won't be just the face. If we only rely on the face, we are accurate enough to get published in Science magazine and have no practical usefulness. We'll miss 30% of liars if we only deal with the face.
Let's back up, though, for a little bit. Okay, lying is a big deal, and I know that's one of the things that got people wild about your work, the application to that. But there's also a lot of stuff. You have a lot of work about sort of the language of the face, kind of this transcultural, universal. I mean, tell me how much the face reveals and how the face reveals about emotion in particular.
Well, the work I did in New Guinea, really, 1967 and 68, a long time ago, did establish, much to my surprise, that Margaret Mead was wrong and Darwin was right. There are seven emotions that have a universal expression, and it doesn't matter what your culture is or your language. That's what you'll see if someone doesn't want you not to know how they feel. So if somebody wants you to know how they feel, if they're being frank, you don't need anybody to teach you. We all recognize it from a very early age. And there are areas of the brain that are dedicated to facial emotion recognition.
Right,
but it's when it's being concealed. Now, we also developed, if you like, musical notation for the face, the only, and still the only, system for completely describing and quantifying anything a human face can do. One of the problems with artists is and there's no reason for them not to do it, since the object is in truth, it's entertainment, it's interest, it's curiosity, but they do things the face can't do. There are only seven things you can do with your eyebrows. No more, no less.
These things that are not facially possible that an artist will put on a canvas, can we read that or does it baffle us?
It sometimes does both. And we extrapolate, and we're intrigued because we see something we haven't seen before. So if I wanted to get people to look at, I might not put on whatever you're going to sing. I might put things on that no one could ever see, and we'd wonder about it.
Right.
And I'd sell my paintings.
I want to go back to Darwin. He's one of my great heroes. I know. Yes. I know you describe yourself as standing on the shoulders of Darwin and certain
That's
other
right.
people. But it seems like from an evolutionary perspective, it makes a lot of sense. As a kind of coordinating things, that I should be able to display to you what I'm feeling when I choose to display to you what I'm feeling, right? But it also makes a lot of sense that, you know, if I want your wife, and I don't know that you want, and your wife wants me, and we don't want you to know it because you'll go in a rage, right? That we have these devices for concealing, right? For not revealing. I mean, how good is the human being at making known what it wants to make, he or she wants, and not making known what, I mean, how good are
most they? People are terrible liars and terrible lie catchers, but they get away with it because most of the time, we don't want to know the truth. Do you want to find out your kid's using hard drugs, your spouse is cheating on you, the person you recommended is embezzling from the company? Those are not pleasant truths, and we collusively
really, but if we did that all the time, wouldn't we? I mean, looking at it from a Darwinian evolutionary perspective, if we were really terrible at this, at not hiding valuable information, just as if we were really terrible at communicating valuable information, you know, that would help us coordinate it. Wouldn't we be wiped out if we were too, you know?
Well, not in the, you know, 95% of the time humans were on this planet, they lived in small hunting-gathering societies where they couldn't deal with predators and prey without cooperation. And there's always, I mean, the name of the game with an evolutionary perspective on human behavior is variation. So there's always going to be an outlier who's going to lie. They usually get caught because you trip on them in the bushes with your spouse, and then they're ostracized, and then and their offspring are dead. So they don't put things into the gene pool. Now, in the current environment...
Right, I see what you're saying. Yes. I see what you're saying. Because it's current environment, complicated.
The current environment...
They end up in national office, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Or at least trying to get it. I mean, you can rent rooms by the hour. There were no... In the pre-literate culture I lived in, there were no rooms with doors. And you couldn't change villages, change names, change spouses, change locations.
So now I'm coming up with... So in the evolutionary environment for which we're evolved, in which lots of face-to-face interaction, you can see the value of facial communication. You can see why there might be a universal facial language. You can see why that all sort of stuff. But now when we have less face-to-face communication, right, when we interact with people in all these kind of ways, I mean, doesn't our built environment, as it were, make lying a lot simpler?
No, I don't really think so. Most people are really lousy liars. Only about 4 or 5% to people, and we've studied quite a number of people, are very good at it for peculiar or unknown reasons. But, you know, we wouldn't be engaged in mating. We wouldn't buy advertisers' products without face-to-face communication. You know, if you study the blind, who can't see faces of others, it's an enormous social handicap. Expressive teachers have as a consequence that their kids learn more. We don't like to see unexpressive people. We want to know, how are you feeling? I not only like your head shakes, but your occasional little smiles that you give me. So there you go. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about faces, feelings, and lies with world-renowned psychologist Paul Ekman. And we've got questions from our live audience here at the Marsh. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ben.
Welcome, Dr. Ekman. Thank you so much for your work. I'm Llewellyn Schaefer from Palo Alto. Have two quick questions. One, I'm intrigued that I could perhaps in an hour learn how to read micro expressions. Can I and how? And two, I know that your work on cross-cultural from New Guinea said that facial expressions are similar pan-culturally. Have you found lately that perhaps there are exceptions to this culturally? Thanks.
www.paulekman.com. It's online. It's so dull to teach. That's what motivated me to get it online, so I'd never have to teach it again. It's not dull to learn. I mean, there's probably a lesson there. You get a lot of feedback in an hour, but once you learn it, you can't turn it off, and you may not always like what you see. No, we have not found, you know, you can't get anything published now with showing another culture. No one has been able to come up with anything beyond these seven emotions that have a universal signal in the face. Now, the voice, there's just a recent study published, a young woman, Disa Sauter, that has shown the voice is the primary signal for the different enjoyable emotions. Think of the difference between amusement and relief. Boy, they have... pretty much look the same on the face, but they sound entirely different. Amusement and relief are as different as fear is from anger. But it isn't the face that signals it. We have a dual system. You wouldn't be able to bring up infants if you had to only look at their face. You could never do anything else. The voice catches you and lets you know how they're feeling.
We've got another question on this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Jesse. I'm from the Mission District in San Francisco. I have two questions. There's a condition known as Tourette's. One expression of this condition is that the person afflicted cannot suppress inappropriate statements. Are conditions like Tourette's or even Asperger's syndrome, et cetera, really diseases presenting too much truth? And are those without these afflictions, in a sense, always lying?
Got that question? That was a mouthful. You got that, Paul?
Neither Tourette's people nor Asperger's, as far as the research has been done, are better communicators or better concealers. There's lots of interference, particularly with Tourette's, of doing a lot of different things that are distracting and not easy to look at. Asperger's is another whole... There's work on Asperger's really is mostly the last 10 years. And there's a lot of work looking at how you can socially enable Asperger's to be able to communicate how they're feeling and recognizing in others. And there's some progress being made.
I want to ask you a different kind of question. So this ability to read the face, this facial language of the emotion, it seems to be connected to a broader ability that we have just to understand people, not just their affective states, but their their beliefs, their intentions. Is it? Or are they part of
thoughts
the same thing?
Thoughts
have
no signal. You don't know what I was just thinking. Yeah, maybe I was just thinking about Obama's State of the Union, or maybe I was thinking about my mother. Thoughts have no signal at all. They're private. And I try to reassure people when they meet me, you say, oh, my God, you're going to read my mind. No,
I can only read your
emotions.
I agree that I can't read your thoughts off your face, but people are pretty good. I mean, there's all this work.
I have to tell you.
Well, there's all this work on developed children's theory of mind about false belief task and all that stuff. People are pretty good at somehow figuring out what other people think. Just wondering if the two abilities are all connected.
If I don't want you to know how I think, I'm not going to tell you. It's really easy. I can just shut my mouth. And yeah, I can't shut my face nearly as easily.
You can't shut off your behavior. I mean, look, I now know that you believe that cup was on the table. You reached for it at the table.
Right.
I mean, you didn't tell me that. I know something about your behavior and how it relates to your beliefs.
Right.
I'm just wondering
it seems to me that it's a difference between figuring out and detecting, right? I mean,
right.
Assuming he's not really into making us believe things that aren't true about what he's thinking, in which case he might be grabbing for things that aren't there, we can develop a pretty good theory about what he's seeing, what's on his mind. But it's not something you detect in 1/20th of a second.
Right. Yeah.
Words were made for invention, creation, and deception. Obama called me yesterday and said, "How'd you like my speech?" I think I said that in a very convincing way. It's totally untrue. Totally untrue. I wish he had, but he didn't.
Yeah.
So I can say anything I want rather convincingly.
We've got lots of questions here. On this side of the auditorium, welcome to Philosophy Talks.
Hi, Dr. Ekman. This is an honor to meet you.
Thank you.
A number of years ago, I wrote a book based on your research, Nonverbal Behavior in the Classroom, focusing on the teacher. To that end, do you still believe that the communication process in general is still about 97% non-word?
Well, actually, that was not my work. That was Albert Mehrabian's work. And really never has held up. That's what you're talking about. If I want to tell you how to get to the post office, boy, I can't do that with my face. You know, I'm going to draw pictures in the air and I'm going to use words. But if I want to tell you how I feel about the work that you've done, I can try to do it with words, and if I'm a poet, I'll do a really good job. But my face is going to give you much more. So it really depends on what the issue is.
On this side of the room, welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Pleasure to see you and talk to you. So I'm taking a seminar on emotions at Stanford, and read a paper by you and by a gentleman called Russell, your rebuttal to him. You laid the claim that emotions are universal, and I think the evidence is really strong and convincing. And by the way, the class was convinced that the emotions are universal.
Very good.
The facial expressions are universal. And yet this theme of seeming to contradict that and trying to find evidence against that keeps coming up. I mean, Russell tried it, Barrett is trying it. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, what is the philosophical underpinning of that? Why do people have an unpleasant time with that idea?
Well, one of my former students, Alan Friedland, said the only way you make a name is by attacking someone who's well-known. So don't take what I say seriously, but that's how I'm going to get tenure. That's one explanation. Another explanation is that for many people, particularly for cognitive psychologists, words are emotions. Now, I view words as representations of emotion. There are emotions that we all have for which we have no word in the English language. I mean, I'll have to admit, I do take pleasure when I hear that somebody I really dislike for their vile acts has had some misfortune. The Germans have a name for that. We don't. That doesn't mean we don't feel it. So if you focus on the language of emotion, you're going to find huge cultural differences. Yeah. If you focus on the physiology and expression, and to some extent the social context in which emotions occur, you'll find universal.
So I want to ask, I want to follow up on that. This has something to do with what John was saying about Hume. Hume says you got the feeling could be associated with different emotions, total emotional states, because there are different background beliefs, different objects you respond to, right? I mean, when you say we can read the, quote, emotion off the face, can we do more than read sort of positive, negative? Can we read this fine-grained stuff John was referring to?
Yes. Now, I'm a great admirer of Hume. Darwin, before he wrote his Descent of Man book, reread Hume. He was very influenced by Hume. But hearing what you said earlier about Hume, the sensations are emotion-specific. So the feeling of anger, and George Lakoff has shown this in language, we've shown it in physiology. Anger is heat under pressure. Fear has a totally different set of physical sensations. So yes, there are sensations. No, displeasure is too gross a term for the different sensations for anger, fear, sadness, and disgust.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing faces, feelings, and lies with psychologist and author Paul Ekman.
Thanks to the shoe bomber of a few years ago and the more recent underwear bomber, and of course going back to the 9/11 terrorists, we go through long lines at airports to put ourselves and our carry-ons through expensive machines. Could common sense psychology and our ability to detect motions supplement this in some way or replace some of it and be useful in dealing with terrorism, sabotage, and all sorts of things? We'll explore this in our next segment.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. And that's no lie.
And you're Ken Taylor, and that's no lie either.
I'm Ken Taylor, too.
We're discussing faces, feelings, and lies with Paul Ekman, consultant for the Fox television series Lie to Me, author of Telling Lies, Clues to Deceit in the Marketplace, Politics, and Marriage. And there's what it looks like, so you can pick it up at the bookstore without too much...
But Paul, I'm starting to think if I went to one of your classes, I did this online thing, that if I could have talked to the Christmas underwear bomber for a moment or two, I would have been pretty suspicious, especially armed with your work. Does your work suggest that we're missing the boat and relying on high technology for screening passengers? I mean, shouldn't we just grill them a bit?
Listen, terrorism, a terrorist act like destroying or hijacking a plane, fortunately, it's a very rare event, but with a very high cost. So you're looking for a needle in a haystack. That's really tough. And you want a multi-layered approach. You want to look at baggage and your metal detectors, whatever other technology, but you also want to use the best computer we have, which is between the ears, if you train it. I train people in Israel, in England, at Heathrow, and a few of the people here. And there is evidence already for those who have been trained on how to evaluate demeanor.
So let me ask you a question. Suppose, though, I'm a pretty upstanding citizen, but if some cop or security person was to start to grill me, I'd just be nervous just because a cop or a security person was grilling me, because I'm an African-American guy. You never know what they're going to do. I mean, how do you correct for that? I mean, some people are just made nervous by being put on the spotlight. How do you correct for that kind of thing?
Well, you raised a lot of important issues. One is racial profiling, which we don't do. In fact, why TSA was enthusiastic about my approach, because it's behavioral profiling. You don't care who shows it. You care that somebody is showing what we call, if you don't mind the word, anomalous behavior. They're doing things that no one else is doing. It could be with their gaze, their face, their posture, their clothing, their facial expression, who they're talking to, where they're looking. It's anomalous, and that just simply causes you to go up and ask a few questions of the person. Most of the time, perfectly innocent. Occasionally, there's been a very high payoff, and
I think we can protect privacy, not interfere with people's flow through airports, but have this layer.
I understand, but I'm just wondering how many sort of false positives one gets.
I'll give you a finding that the American Institute of Research now has, because they were commissioned by Homeland Security to check this. If you pick passengers out at random and then search their stuff, and you use the training that I've given to screen people, 11 times as many are found to have contraband, guns, money, drugs, or to be wanted felons if you do it not randomly, but on the basis of behavior. It's 132,000 people that were studied. So you're not... How many false positives? Lots. But if your boredom is relieved while you're standing on a line, that's not much of a consequence.
How would you conceive it working? So I go to SFO. The first person I meet is the person that looks at my driver's license, the boarding pass. Would that person be trained?
No. The people who are trained, and there are some SFO, not enough, they are called BDOs, behavior detection officers. and they have been trained in my methods, and they are standing off by the side. You probably don't notice them. They're watching. They're looking for this anomalous behavior.
There's the BVDs that check the underwear.
We got lots of questions here. I don't know if we'll get through them all. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Ekman. I want to go back to where we started at the program about art and the ability to read faces in art. There are certain faces that just fascinated us and fascinated us for hundreds of years. For example, Mona Lisa's face. Why is that? And then as a bonus question, can you tell us what she's thinking?
No, I can never tell what I can tell what someone may be feeling about what they're thinking, but thoughts have no signal. Thoughts are private. And I can never interpret much from a single frame. I need to see something move on off the face. I mean, I'm not an art expert or historian. Of course, I've looked at Mona Lisa's face a lot of times. It's an odd smile. It's not what we call a genuine smile. That's one thing about it. She's looking and facing in a different direction. That's another intriguing thing. I think she's caught in the middle of a flirtation, okay? And that's what intrigues us.
There's all sorts of work on just the human capacity for face recognition and sort of putting together composite faces and predicting what kind of faces humans will find attractive. And there's all this wonderful work. You can make up these faces and you can know that they're going to be found beautiful, right? Have you done much work on that kind of
thing? I follow that literature, but really the emotions are performed on the stage of identity. I mean, the chief function of the face is to know who you are. That's why what you have in your wallet or purse are pictures of faces, not elbows, not hands. That's what we mostly identify the self with the face. And it's a remarkable thing. Very rarely does somebody come up to you and call you by a different name because they think you're another person. But this identity recognition system, on top of that, we have expressions performed which look a little different depending on the features and the age and all of that.
The human brain has a lot of machinery dedicated to this, right?
That's more to the face than any other thing, and more, incidentally, to what you're looking at. Think how important it is to know whether someone's looking at you.
On this side of the room, welcome
Dave
to Philosophy Talk
with Dave Gomberg with the question for Dr. Ekman. We all know that there are people who can lie superbly, and I once had an employee who I knew she lied routinely and seemed to do it for sport. I still couldn't catch her at it, except after the fact, if she lied in a preposterous way. My question is, how do these people become that way? Are they born that way, or is it something they develop deliberately, or is it something they fall into?
We don't know the answer to that scientifically. We do know that they're a small percentage of the people, and they tend to be rather charming. And they get into, some of them exploited in acting, sales, politics, whole variety.
Okay, I've got a proposition for you. I know they're paying you a lot for this lie detection stuff.
No.
Can I offer you a proposition in which you teach a family of a class of liars? You know, I mean, all the crooks, the bad guys.
I don't work that side of the street.
Yeah.
I don't run a school for liars. I've been asked by one president. I won't tell you who. I run a school for lie catchers.
Yeah. This side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Pat.
Hi, Dr. Ekman. This is Tori from Pleasant Hill. When do humans begin to deceive, and what does it look like?
Between 3 and 5, most kids will lie and know that they're not saying the truth, and they're terrible liars. Right. By the age of 8, they're as good as adults, which means they can get away with it, but they're really not. Nobody's really, very few. The fellow over there mentioned an exceptional person.
Is it before, roughly age 4 or something like that? Do I have this right? Children don't really get the distinction between my beliefs and your beliefs. They think the world shares their beliefs by and large. So when they're very young, they don't really have the capacity to lie, do they?
There's an argument in the scientific literature about that.
Yeah.
And I'm not taking sides.
You're neutral about
that's
that?
That's the truth. I'm neutral. Okay. I mean, I didn't design the system. I just observe it.
On this side of the room.
I'm Susan Ravens from Berkeley, California. And John Edwards could have become president of the United States. The American press in general was not on top of the issue, could not figure out whether he was lying. It was only the National Enquirer which really came through and seems to be the only paper that comes through and figures out who's lying in our society. So I was wondering, did you think personally that John Edwards was making up the stories about the child? And did you have a feeling he was a liar previously?
Well, I wasn't watching. One of the networks is now getting me his appearance on Nightline where he denies that that's his child. And I'm going to take a look and see with hindsight whether I could see whether there's any clue to it. I mean, politicians tend to be a lot, except for Bill Clinton, they tend to be a lot better as lying. Clinton got caught all the time. A smart guy like Bill Clinton got caught time after time after time. But many politicians are really quite adept. It's one of the reasons they get into it in this television age. So I should have an answer to your question in about a month.
Thank you.
I want to clear something up. You said people are bad at lying, but you also said people are bad at detecting lies.
Right.
Most of us think we can spot a liar when we see one.
Yes.
Given that people are bad at lying, why isn't it true that most of us can spot a liar?
Well, you don't get feedback. I mean, if you think someone's lying to you, unless you're a policeman, and even with a policeman, they don't get feedback when they make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they find out they made a mistake, somebody's been spent 20 years in jail, they can't remember why they made the mistake. So people sometimes ask me, why do you train police? I'd like less mistakes.
Okay, we got last question.
Thank you. I'm Robert Solly. I live in San Francisco, about 5 blocks away. I understand, and you can correct me if this is wrong, but one of your mentors was able to tell by looking at people something about their character quite accurately, actually. And I wondered if you could comment on that in light of also a recent study that people were able to judge sort of bullies from non-bullies pretty accurately.
Do you know that you can tell from the face testosterone level? Maybe that's already an intuitive ability in females to spot that. No one's tested in females. But I never thought I'd be able to, but I did quite well. That was Sylvan Tompkins that you're referring to. And unfortunately, he died before he made how he did that public. It's a secondary inference, I believe. The face is, we do know that people agree. We have data that people really agree on who's trustworthy. And we know it's totally worthless. It's a stereotype. We have lots of stereotypes that mislead us about the intelligent face, the trustworthy face, etc. Is there accurate information? Perhaps yet to be documented.
Okay, Paul, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been an enlightening conversation, and that's not at all a lie. Our guest has been Paul Ekman. He's the world-renowned expert on facial expressions and the emotions. He's a scientific consultant for the Fox television series Lie to Me. He's a prolific author, a very prolific author. We've been talking a lot about his book, Telling Lies, Clues to Deceit in the Marketplace, Politics, and Marriage.
We also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program. Would you give yourselves a round of applause?
So, John, what are your closing thoughts here?
Oh, my closing thoughts. I'm just a swarm with thoughts, and I couldn't keep
from thinking about something that Paul Ekman said early on about the difference between the small groups where, you know, it was pretty hard to lie without being detected, not because it would show up in your face, but because there weren't any doors and things like that, to the much different structure of society we have now. And, you know, we need to think hard about how we're encouraging or providing a very nice niche for liars.
Right, I think that's right. I mean, some evolutionary psychologists have this view that we're kind of evolved to detect people who violate social contracts, social norms, and that has to do with, you know, evolving in the small circle. But I wish we could have explored more with him whether, given the sort of informational structures we have, all this stuff just doesn't work anymore.
Of course,
but we didn't get a really chance to get into it.
We're headed to a world where there's a video cam on every corner, and people think that's terrible, but, you know, it may be just be a return just even to small town America where you couldn't really get away with anything.
In any case, this well, I don't know about that.
Well, you you weren't raised in as small a town as I was.
This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. We also have a growing Facebook community, and we'd love to invite you all to join our Facebook. It's a very lively spot on Facebook.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word, we turn to the high-speed half-truths of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the recent success of the movie Avatar has created a subsection of viewers who left the movie depressed. Apparently, the movie became more convincing than the world outside the theater. Tall blue hippies from outer space seem more real to them now than their own dates. This can either be seen as a salute to Hollywood's skill in creating an alternate reality or a sad reminder that life as you know it doesn't have much to offer, especially when it comes to tall blue hippies from outer space. What makes the movie so compelling are new advances in 3D motion capture. Previous attempts at creating credible humanish creatures failed, largely because their faces look like they have been injected with Botox. But now these computer-generated characters have more expressiveness than we do, because we're the ones on the Botox. This might pose a problem for airport security as we all stand seething and shoeless in line for our gates. Still, there are all sorts of face recognition projects in the works to look for terrorist behavior indicators. One such project is called Future Attribute Screening Technology, or FAST, being tested by the Department of Homeland Security. It includes a thermal imaging device to measure facial temperatures, an eye tracker to measure blink rates and pupil dilation, machines to track heart rates and respiration, and a fidgeting monitor. FAST has been tried out in Maryland, according to New Scientist, using 140 paid volunteers who walked through a pair of trailers kitted out with the equipment. The subjects were told to act shifty, be evasive, deceptive, and hostile, and many were detected. DHS science spokesman John Verico said, quote, "We're still very early on in this research, but it is looking very promising. We are running at about 78% accuracy in malintent detection and 80% on deception," unquote. Just to get this straight, subjects were told to act shifty, evasive, deceptive, and hostile, yet this equipment still missed 20% of them. Looks like we're going to be barefoot in the assembly line for a while yet. Maybe Homeland Security could take a tip from Facebook, which is very adept at recognizing faces. Sure, it only recognizes the faces that users put on Facebook, but that face can be remarkably revealing. As a matter of fact, there seems to be something intrinsic in Facebook that compels us to reveal what the internet calls TMI, or too much information. Some examples, people post the colors of their bras. One woman posted, "My breasts smell like chicken tenders." How did she know? People post pictures of themselves passed out at parties and posing with weapons. People proudly describe their baby's first bowel movement. Post from the hospital beds about their operations, and even post pictures of themselves giving birth. There are drama queens, heartless bastards, drunk sorority girls, guys and gals who post themselves making out with their new B&GFs before unfriending the old B&GFs, leading to epic flame wars. There are baby please don't goes and bye-byes and good riddances and baby comebacks and breakups right there in the Facebook community to see. There's a woman who complained on Facebook about what a jerk her boss was. She apparently forgot that she had friended her boss. He saw the post and fired her right there on Facebook. So my suggestion is get rid of all the surveillance equipment. Instead, make everybody in the whole world sign up for Facebook. We will always tell the truth on our Facebook page. We can't help ourselves. Give access to the internet for security guards at the airport. Ask the passenger his or her name. Then access that passenger's Facebook page. It'll be, "OMG, my water just broke," or "Here I am puking on a couch." Or, if they fall into the trap, it'll be posts like, "Hey, I'm a terrorist, LOL. Check out the IED in my tidy-whities." and Al-Qaeda is da bomb. It's foolproof, unless you're an alien, of course, in which case you won't have a Facebook page, but even there you give yourself away by your tallness and your highly expressive, mobile, blue, unbotoxed face. Damn hippie. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Kadar Lawrence, Joe Burke, and Arnie Warshaw.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Andy McDaniel, Merle Kessler, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Stanford Humanities Center, various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.